Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The current situation in Iraq is yet again perilous. Analysts are saying that the Islamic State is about to launch a major offensive, but one built around commando raids and suicide bombings. Or to put it more in more literary terms, here's how journalist and defense expert Thomas Ricks sees it.
I keep on thinking in terms of Shakespearean tragedy, and I think we're probably only in Act 4 right now. Act 5, you know, the bloody conclusion of Hamlet or Macbeth, still has not happened.
That's from the new Frontline documentary, The Powerful Losing Iraq. Here with us in Studio 3 is Frontline producer Michael Kirk. Michael, an incredible piece of work yet again. Good to see you.
You too.
Yeah, ditto. Just an incredible and very, very sobering and upsetting piece of work. So it's been 2.5 years since we left. As Jim just mentioned, everybody knows things are in a mess again in Iraq. And you trace how we got there, what went right and what went wrong, and where we are now. So let's start at the beginning here. How we got there at the very beginning. Explain where your piece starts.
We start at the sort of 3 days after the thunder runs have happened and the tanks have rolled into Baghdad and Saddam has disappeared and the deck of cards are hiding somewhere. And the people of Iraq go to a square in the middle of Baghdad and try to pull down the iconic, their version of the Statue of Liberty, the statue of Saddam Hussein. And as we say in the film and as people we interviewed there at the time say, it became a sort of metaphor for how hard it was to pull the statue down. I don't think anybody understood that it was made of solid brass and steel and that it was not. The Marine Corps had to go in and kind of help. They hung an American flag over it. Then that looked terrible on CNN, so they pulled that flag down and stuck an Iraqi flag, which somebody managed to have. They pull it down. But in effect, it is the metaphor for what was to follow. And you could probably, as one person says, trace the roots of that moment all the way to the insurgency.
And then what we didn't know was what happened, at least I didn't know it, almost immediately after that statue came down, things began falling apart almost right away.
We had no idea, and we didn't have enough troops. And those of us who were watching it, and even those of us who were covering it, had no idea that there had been months in the Pentagon where no planning had taken place. Where they talked about how to take the country, move over it and roll through it in 3 weeks. But virtually no planning had taken place about what to do in the moment that Saddam was gone. The Ba'athist Party stayed home, and the people who ran the country, and we were there with only 130,000 troops in a city of 5 million and lots of pent-up anger that was and thirst for money and anything they could do that just erupted in those immediate first 48 hours.
You know, when you hear Michael say things like he says, you probably are saying, well, those are what the anti-war activists thought. These are generals that are saying, these are envoys, these are ambassadors that say this throughout the film. And when Paul Bremer, and you can describe his qualifications in a minute, is picked to essentially run the show over there, the image of him, his first day in Baghdad, and he sees fires everywhere, and they're not being put out. Why are they not being put out, Michael Kirk?
There was no police force. There was no fire department. Buildings, gigantic buildings, large buildings. Imagine downtown Boston, where periodically the Prudential catches on fire or someplace else catches on fire. And there was nobody to put the fires out. So they just stepped back, and Baghdad was literally burning as he drove into the community. He's driving in an SUV. He's looking out the window, and he's seeing looting taking place, not just of the ministries, but of businesses by now and homes. The place is on fire. The people tell him they can't put the fires out. And he gets to the compound, what becomes known as the Green Zone. And his first sort of order at the staff meeting is, why don't we shoot the looters and send a message to the people that that they shouldn't be doing this?
In fact, we have that sound, which is incredible. The diplomat, Paul Bremer, who knew virtually nothing about the Middle East, here, as Michael just described, is how his first day went.
I did one thing that wasn't very smart, which was suggest to the staff meeting that I thought we should shoot the looters, that our military should have authority to shoot the looters, which they did not have at that time. This wasn't very smart to do because somebody on the staff immediately told the press that I had suggested shooting the looters and we had a problem.
Military commanders refused to go along with Bremer's idea.
Well, of course, it's against our code of honor. There just is not sufficient justification to shoot somebody because they're carrying a computer out of the old Ministry of Education building.
And so ended Paul Bremer's first day in Iraq.
And I think one thing Bremer found out that day is that he had no command over the military.
You know, I love that Bremer says the reason it wasn't, quote, very smart is because someone told the press about it, not because it wasn't very smart,
exactly,
but because someone reported it to the media.
Well, this begs the first of many questions. What was Paul Bremer doing there?
Paul Bremer was a card-carrying member of the inner establishment, the people we also always used to call the Trilateral Commission.
Uh-huh.
So he knew Scooter Libby, who worked in Vice President Cheney's office and was Cheney's top aide. Paul Wolfowitz, who was the neoconservative over at the Defense Department working for Don Rumsfeld. And when they were looking for somebody to sort of be the civilian authority, the viceroy, if you will, in Iraq, because they had no plans for what to do after the fighting was over, they were looking for somebody who met a variety of qualifications, one of which is he had to know all of them and they had to feel comfortable with him. They called him Jerry. The other is that it would be better if he didn't know very much about the Middle East, so he didn't have a lot of biases about it. He didn't speak the language. There were a number of things, and he hadn't been a member of the Clinton administration and hadn't had a declared position on anything in that, which sometimes means Israel versus Palestine, and certainly in those days right after 9/11 meant al-Qaeda and other countries, Iran and others, in relation to the United States and in relation to other Middle East hotspots.
Wasn't he Kissinger's right-hand man, you say,
and he was
as well?
Exactly.
And Kissinger's new post-Secretary of State Life.
Exactly. He was the managing director of Kissinger and Associates, which meant he had a finger in many pies all over the world, but not in the Middle East.
You know, I served on the Cambridge City Council for 2 years, and when you watch something like this with the most powerful men, almost with, I guess, Condoleezza Rice is the exception, in the world meeting, and you see they pick Paul Bremer, who has virtually no qualifications for the job except that he's a clean slate, as this part of the world goes. And then when you see who they pick to lead Iraq, who was our hand-picked person, it's almost like they're sitting around at a bar somewhere and saying, so what do you think? And they come up with Maliki based on what criteria?
So Zalmay Khalilzad, the ambassador, knows that it's time to pick a new prime minister because Iraq is really wobbly. He asks around. They can't find. He says, in a country of 30 million people, I can't believe there isn't somebody, some George Washington,
great line,
who's going to step up and, you know, say, I can lead the people. So they find this guy who was, you know, from the south. So he's Shiite. He had been in Syria and Iran during the Saddam days, kind of a bomb thrower, but not really, but an anti-Saddam activist. Not a guy who knew anything about the government. And the CIA comes forward and says, the CIA officer in a meeting with Khalilzad says, I think this guy, al-Maliki, might be the guy, Nouri al-Maliki. And he says, well, I've never heard of him. And everybody else says, I've never heard of him. And Steve Hadley tells us, who was the head of the NSC in the Bush administration, he tells us, I'd never heard of him, and nobody knew anything about him. Well, in some ways, like Bremer, that made him qualified to lead post-war Iraq.
I want to play a little sound about Maliki and what the administration knew about him. But did you, when I watched this last night, and you leave it, and we have much more of the story to tell, with such a sense of condemnation for the people who allowed this thing to implode, was there a piece of you who said there was a little CYA going on the part of some of these folks, some of the generals who were incredibly impressive in this thing, basically trying to cover their own you-know-whats? Or did you not get that sense that this was an honest retelling on their part of what happened and what didn't?
I think there is a sense, surely there is a sense that people want to clean up the history a little bit. That's obvious. That always happens. And in our business, you know that mm-hmm. happens. That's why we get people after the fact who write a book and then come on our programs and talk to us. On the other hand, when you examine really deeply what they actually did at the time, the great thing about making a film over 11 years, as we've done, is that you really know the truth about what they're doing. I think there were so many missteps, so many miscalculations, so much hubris, so much everything. It's almost impossible to point to any single moment, and it's almost impossible to point to any single person. Clearly what Bremer did with CPA 1 and 2, clearly what happened with the picking of Maliki, obviously what happened by picking a date and pulling out and leaving Maliki kind of on his own after we'd been so hardwired into the politics of that country. All of those are critical and important things, but I think a lot of them are missteps, and a lot of them are us as a country just being so kind of burly about it all in a way that seems, you know, worrisome as far
worrisome.
As future adventures
worrisome.
Go. Right?
Let's stay on Maliki for a second. Here is John Burns, again, from the documentary. John Burns, London bureau chief for the New York Times about Maliki.
Yeah.
Nuri Kamal al-Maliki was a kind of default choice. And Maliki is a man who, not to be unkind, I think if you were sitting on a local school board, you'd worry about appointing him to be principal of your local high school.
By May of 2006, the Americans had their man. Nuri al-Maliki was elected the new prime minister of Iraq.
And Nuri al-Maliki was so unknown to so many people in the Bush White House that they weren't even using his right first name. He finally actually had to correct them and tell them that they weren't using the right name. And I think it tells you about how little they understood about him when he first came to power. They were so happy to have somebody.
You know, if it turns out there weren't 4,000 dead Americans and tens of thousands of dead Iraq, you'd laugh at that story that the administration didn't know the name, the proper name of the man they had handpicked to lead Iraq.
It's like Grenada when we didn't have any maps. We had to use gas station maps to fight the battles there. Same kind of a problem.
So let's talk about one of the most upsetting, well, there's so many upsetting parts, but tell people about the Sons of Iraq. Tell them who they are and what they're about.
Well, when the surge happens in 2007, 20,000 to 30,000 American troops come in under General David Petraeus, who's a bit of a counterinsurgency maverick inside the Army.
Whom you interview extensively as well.
Yes, he has come forward after many, many, many requests by us to talk to us at great length, and it's fascinating. It was a wonderful interview. It's on the website, all of it, I think. Anyway, Petraeus realizes that in order to stop the killing of civilians, you've got to separate the Sunni and the Shia. So he, and a lot of Americans die in the process of separating these two warring factions. To stop, he realizes that in order to stop the Sunni up in the north and the west, the people who are now involved with ISIS and threatening Baghdad and the nation of Iraq, to stop them from continuing to kill Shiites and keep a civil war going, he decides to offer them some money. In other words, put them on the American payroll. And that, to me, is one of the great historic moments about what happens in Iraq and the way America plays the role America plays and has always played, even in Vietnam, this kind of a role. A classic counterinsurgency technique where you buy off the other side or as many of the reconcilables as you can buy off.
Okay. Now, you have a very graphic scene of the buy-off in action. Please describe what you capture on film. My jaw dropped. Tell people, Michael.
What's amazing about it is that in secret, the top American general, it's not that he did it without President Bush's permission, but he did it without President Bush's being informed about the specifics of it, starts to meet quietly and secretly with warlords, tribal leaders, and activists in the Sunni militia army and buy them off. And he doesn't buy them off with $50 or $60 or $100. What you see in the film is the actual handing off of tremendous sums of money in rooms with people, people that the general Petraeus eventually calls the Sons of Iraq, and it renames their army, and eventually 103,000 or so of them come on the United States payroll.
For $400 million, is that what the figure was?
The final number, at least that we know of, it may be more than this, is $400 million.
Yeah, you're being too modest.
Describe the scene of these soldiers with these stacks of money. I said to you before we went on the air, it looks like Scarface or some big-time drug deal, with stacks, tens of thousands of dollars in neat little...
Counting them out.
Yes, and handing them across the table. And these guys are picking them up and putting them in their pocket.
When we were editing the sequence, the editor looked over at me when somebody counted out $10, $20, $30, $40,000 and hands it to one of the Sons of Iraq. And you see it actually happening in real life right there on camera. The editor looked at me and said, there are people in America who, when they see this, that's a year's salary. They're going to be outraged at the idea that we laid out that kind of money. Now, it is true that it did stop the killing in the North and the West. But at the same time, the cost was a lot higher, I think, than many of us.
Well, also some of the people getting the money were the very same people who killed Americans prior to joining...
Lots of Americans.
Lots of Americans. But we're talking to Michael Kirk, who is the producer of this spectacular frontline documentary called Losing Iraq. It's going to be on WGBH Channel 2 tonight at 10 o'clock. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
But you do talk, Michael Kirk, in the film about that was the moment, the brief moment, where things seemed to quiet down in Iraq was during the surge. But, of course, that did not last. So what happened after that?
Well, Barack Obama becomes president, inherits the war, but has promised during the campaign that he will stop the war. George Bush has negotiated a three-year with Maliki, and Maliki and Bush become like best
friends.
Very
good friends.
They have a kind of bromance, one person
told. They do. Right. Maliki was pining for George Bush after. Can I call him? Can I still talk to him?
Because Barack Obama wouldn't talk to him, right?
As far as we can tell, according to the current ambassador, we've talked to all three of the ambassadors, Crocker, Jeffrey, and Khalilzad. And they all said that Bush would talk almost weekly, give these weekly teleconferences with Maliki about how to run the politics of the country, which is astonishing by itself, and that Obama has maybe spoken, the ambassador said he thought two, maybe three times to Maliki in the entire time. Obama becomes president, and really this is in the rearview mirror as far as he's concerned.
Yep.
The war is something he campaigned against. People voted for him, and it's one of the reasons he sees, and he doesn't really want it as part of any kind of legacy that he has, and he really walks away from it in every way. Pulls the troops out just on schedule, just as he promised he would.
Against the advice of the leading generals.
And the Defense Department.
Yeah, and by the way, a lot of us cheered him honoring his commitment, but your film speaks to the fact that there was a much deeper level of neglect than just honoring a campaign pledge, correct?
Yes, here's the thing I don't think anybody, including me, who followed the story very closely, or any of us in the press who didn't follow it after we pulled out in 2011, really, everybody was happy to walk away from Iraq. It was like Vietnam all over again. We're done. We're gone. We did the best we could. Let's get away from there. And especially with a president who's new and has lots of other things on his agenda, including an economy that's faltering and crashing left and right. What we didn't, I don't think anybody understood or wasn't apparently able to get through to him about, or the people on his staff about, was the extent to which we were hardwired into their politics. Maliki did nothing. The Sunnis did nothing. The communication in the country was still all broken, except that people like Petraeus would go back and forth and carry messages and broker deals all the time. There were, this was to my astonishment, 16,000 people in the State Department in Iraq. It was the biggest embassy we have anywhere, had anywhere in the world. 10,000 of them left right after the troops pulled out, down to 6,000 of them. The military was saying, wait a minute, we're not going to know what's happening if we don't have at least 20,000 people there. He Obama bargained them down to 10 and then 5, and then they finally, he and Maliki really realized they didn't really want anybody there. Maliki was, who had been playing us against the Iranians and keeping himself out of trouble with the Iranians. Now, if he didn't have Americans in there, he was a little worried about what Iran was going to do in his country. And he was very worried about what would happen with the Sunni and his own generals, whether there'd be a coup. So without us there, keeping the peace in that way we did after the surge had sort of, quote unquote, worked, was a big blow to what was going to happen there. And none of us, especially the president of the United States, who you might expect to know that, knew it.
And so Barack Obama, despite the fact that he and others are trashing Maliki, invites him over to do, I think this is not unfair, his version of mission accomplished. He's not in a flight suit. There's not a sign behind him like there was with George Bush, I guess, in 2003. But he holds a joint press conference, turns over sovereignty to Maliki, even though people in the administration know, at least have some semblance of what a mess it is. And then almost immediately, when Maliki takes charge, there are dramatic changes. Before we went on the air, Michael, what great television show did you like in the behavior of Maliki post our withdrawal to?
Maybe this is unfair as a journalist to say, but I think the image is strong enough that it's a fair thing to say in terms of the image anyway. There's a picture we have in the film that when Maliki is walking out of a room with all of the guy, his guys behind him, that is very Tony Soprano-like.
I think so, too.
it dawned on me that, oh, my God, he the day after we leave, turns his guys loose on the vice president, the Sunni vice president, Mr. Hashemi, and he's eventually indicted for murder. A lot of very tough, nasty charges. He denies them, but is spirited off into Turkey by his people, where he's under police protection there. But it's the beginning of what becomes just an unbelievable purge by Maliki of the Sunni connections, and his own generals are removed from the army, and henchmen of his, of sycophants, are put in charge. Those are the generals that evacuated when ISIS was coming in through Mosul, and the army took off their uniforms and ran for cover.
Michael Kirk, before we ask you what the moral of the story is out of this incredible documentary that you did in three, did you do this in 3.5 what, weeks?
We put it together in 3.5
weeks.
Unbelievable. Which is unbelievable. Before we do that, let's hear from Ryan Crocker, who served as U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and Iraq.
Pushing toward Baghdad.
This is analogous to Afghanistan, August 2001. This time, it is Al-Qaeda version 6.0. They make bin Laden's Al-Qaeda look like Boy Scouts. They are far stronger. They are far more numerous. They have thousands who hold foreign passports and require no visas to get into the United States or other Western countries. They are well-funded. They are battle-hardened. And they are well-armed. And they now control far more territory exclusively than bin Laden ever did.
Chilling. So what is the moral of the story? People watch 90 minutes of Frontline tonight. What do they go home with? What do they take away?
Well, you'll see the missteps and the mismanagement and the misdirection and worse, you'll see the mendacity of some American politicians. You'll see all of that laid before you over 11 years. You'll see the lack of learning. I have many friends who were reporters during the Vietnam era around the White House who say Vietnam always lives in the Oval Office, and I think now Iraq is a partner to Vietnam living in the Oval Office. It will haunt presidents for a long, long time, especially if something really bad comes. I share Tom Rick's feeling that this is the fourth act. The fifth act is coming. Obviously, we'll be around to cover it and see it and try to learn whatever lessons there are to learn from it. But one of them is we went in, remember the famous Colin Powell phrase, if you break it, you buy it. Well, we're buying it now.
Michael Kirk, another terrific piece of work. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael, for coming in. Michael Kirk is the producer of this incredible documentary that you've really got to see, Frontlines, Losing Iraq. You can watch it tonight at 10 on WGBH's Channel 2. Michael, thank you so much for your great work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Maggie.
Coming up, we're going to ask you if the United States should have mandatory service. As citizens, should we be obliged to commit our time to something beyond ourselves, especially in light of what we saw all these young men and women doing and continuing to do in Iraq and Afghanistan? That's up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.